And good evening and welcome to Bird Calls from Red River Radio, made possible by the Knoll Foundation and the Community Foundation of North Louisiana. We invite you to call in with your questions tonight about our feathered friends, both the and the avian world, during this show at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. Cliff Shackelford is our resident ornithologist here at Red River Radio, and he is ready to answer your questions about birds tonight. Cliff is currently the statewide non-game ornithologist for the Texas Parks and Wildlife Department, a position he has held since 1997, and he has been an avid bird watcher for over 30 years. He is also the first author of the book Hummingbirds of Texas, published in 2005 by Texas A&M University Press, and he's authored over 70 publications on birds and birding. He and his wife, Julie, and their two children live in East Texas. Cliff, thanks so much for joining us again.
Hey, good evening, Bill.
And we are going to get started tonight, as we do always, with last month's conservation tip, a wrap-up of that. But first, let me give the numbers again, 800-552-8502, to call in during the program and ask your question of Cliff. So remind us again, what was last month's conservation
tip? Yeah, last month we talked about having your local licensed wildlife rehabilitator's number handy. Just like you'd have doctor's numbers handy, maybe if you're in the country, the sheriff's number handy. Because you never know when you're going to come across an orphaned or injured bird or other species or, you know, mammal or something else that needs attention. And you want to have that phone number handy. That way you don't fumble around while that critter's, you know, still hurting or bleeding to death and you don't even have the phone number. So look in your area that's, you know, within an hour's drive if possible. There are a lot of areas that don't have licensed rehabilitators. And rehabilitating is not for everyone. You have to be licensed. You have to go through a training course. I mean, it's rigorous. It's tough because you got to quit your day job if you're going to be tending to something that needs to be fed every hour or bandages change. You're going to need to know how to do that. So it's not for everyone. So find your rehabilitator. And also, when you take an animal to them, consider strongly making a donation to that rehabilitator because they're on their own dollar. And so don't just give them stuff to take care of. Give them some money to go with it that will help pay the vet bills, that will help pay for the food. If it's a raptor, it's going to need a lot of meat. It's going to need rats and mice, and that costs money. So, but these rehabilitators are important, and they have a niche to fill, and just be ready for them when you need them because you have no idea when that's going to happen, when you're going to have an injured critter that you need help. So have that phone number ready. Do a little homework. Not right now. Listen to the show, but maybe this is your homework assignment for after the show.
And that actually happened to me. We found an osprey, a young osprey, literally in a parking garage at the University of Florida when I worked there. And he was injured. He had gotten to the garage. He could not fly yet. So he was down in the, you know, with the concrete barriers around it, and he couldn't get back out. And so we had to contact. We blocked off all the cars and tried to, you know, to direct them around where he was. We let him get over into the corner where he felt safe, and then we called the wildlife rehabilitators. Fortunately, we were next to a university, so actually we were on a campus, so they were there close and could go ahead and take care of that bird.
Good. So that was injured. So let me make a comment about orphaned. That's a word that can be very subjective. People walk up on a baby deer, what we call a fawn, and think it's orphaned because the mom's not there. Well, we flushed the mom. And the idea for the young is just to lay there and not move until you go away and mom comes back. So it's not orphan. Don't pick up baby fawns thinking you're going to help it. Leave it alone because mom's going to do the best job. Same thing with baby birds. We get a lot of calls from people having baby blue jays. Well, blue jays tend to leave the nest a little early because they can't really fly that well, but they're running around all over the yard. Don't pick them up. Leave them there because mom is probably watching cautiously from the trees, hoping you go away. So instead of picking up a baby blue jay in the yard, instead gather your pets, your cats and dogs and the children, and bring them inside and let mom and dad do the rest of the work on the baby blue jay or whatever baby it is. So be careful with that term orphaned because it might not be orphaned.
You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. You can give us a call tonight with your questions about our avian world at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. And so, Cliff, we're going to go into this month's spotlight, and can you tell us what we're about to listen to?
Yeah, we profile different birds every episode, and this one is going to be a really neat grassland bird called the Eastern Meadowlark, and it's often referred to as the field lark. So let's listen to this bird right here. Beautiful smooth whistles, and there's its rattle-like call note. So, often referred to as a field lark, this is a grassland obligate, and it has a beautiful song. Some books translate this song to spring of the year, if you like, and they're very vociferous this time of the year if you live in an area with meadowlarks. It's a stocky bird with a short tail that, when flushed, it flashes white in the outer tail. They have yellow on the face, on the throat, and the belly, plus a prominent black breastband. They're found in large grasslands throughout the Red River radio listening area, and if you've stumbled upon one in a pasture, they'll flush from the ground like a quail, which will startle most people. They'll also sit on a commanding perch like a fence post where males will sing to proclaim their territory. Let's listen again as the meadowlark sings. It's a little dim. Here we go. There's the call note. Real nice smooth whistles. So it has a look-alike cousin, the Western meadowlark, that also occurs in our listening area, but only during the colder months. And you might have to go through hundreds and hundreds of Easterns before finding just that one Western. But listen for the Western's very different song of bubbly whistles that they'll sometimes sing during the winter. So Eastern meadowlarks build dome-shaped nests made of fine grasses, which they hide on the ground amongst dense grasses. Eastern meadowlarks are experiencing severe declines across their North American range. In fact, over a 60% decline during the last half century. Many other grassland birds in our area are experiencing similar range-wide declines, including the bobwhite, the loggerhead shrike, and the common thread is the removal of native species of grasses, especially warm-seasoned bunch grasses that have been replaced with non-native carpet grasses, such as coastal Bermuda. So promoting native grasses in our pastures and our open pine stands can provide habitat for meadowlarks, bobwhite, shrikes, and several other grassland birds. And we'll talk more about this during our conservation tip at the end of this episode.
And Cliff, we had a couple of photos sent in to us between last show and this show. One of those was from Jill Wright from Marshall, Texas. And she writes, "My husband took this photo on Sunday afternoon, May 7th, while we were waiting at the Blue Angels, or while we were waiting for the Blue Angels to fly over Barksdale. There were two scissor-tailed flycatchers on the power line adjacent to the parking lot field and where we were all waiting. So he took photos of them. Then this long-tailed guy came into the picture. At first, we thought it was a mockingbird, but up close has ended that theory. However, is it another species is what she asks, and is it another species of flycatcher?"
Yeah, and she did send in a great photograph. The light's a little harsh on it, but you can get all the good features. It does look like it has a long tail. But this bird has a certain stance that once you learn this bird, it doesn't need to have good lighting to see it. This is indeed the northern mockingbird. So they did think it looked like a mockingbird, but upon closer inspection, looked a little different. But this is a mockingbird. If you're unsure, just watch it
or
fly.
Wait and hear it call.
Yeah, wait for it to sing or wait for it to fly, and it'll flash white in the wings and in the outer tail. And that's usually pretty obvious. But this is a mockingbird, and we've got this picture up online for people to see.
That's on our website.
Okay. Great.
And that's redriverradio.org. You can click on the post for birds calls and see a whole bunch of photos this time around, including our meadowlark and the mockingbird there, and this bird by Bob Ritchie, who called in from Kerrville, Texas, home of a great folk festival. Bob found this on Facebook, called a page called Texas Birds, and says the owner gave him permission to use this. The image was taken in South Llano River State Park, and Bob would like to know exactly what kind of bird that is.
Yeah, and Kerrville's way out of our listening area, which is great to have people call in or send in pictures from out. That's even farther west than San Antonio. And this picture, which you can also see online, is a male painted bunting. But the interesting thing about this bird is it's supposed to have a bright lime green back, but this bird's back is a little bit maroon colored, and I never know if that's someone tweaking with their camera or maybe it's just an odd bird. It'd be really neat to know if this is just an anomaly in the bird world. So a lot of colors in birds' feathers are due to diet. So a lot of your reds and different hues and shades of red are going to be due to carotenoids that they get in their diet. But I don't know what's going on with this bird, if it's a part of the camera that did this or it's just a very odd-looking bird. But it's indeed a male painted bunting. And somebody might say, well, maybe it's a hybrid with something. I don't think it is. I just think it's, if the camera's not doing it, if this is really the true colors of the bird, it just has something going on with just an anomaly. I mean, we've got it in the human world too. We're not all looking identical, and sometimes we've got some oddities, and then this one it's a pretty cool looking oddity, although I really like that lime green back on most painted buntings. I did see one last June out in the Trans-Pecos near Alpine, Texas, that it was a male painted bunting. It's supposed to have a red throat that goes into a red chest and breast, in other words, all red underside. Well, this individual I saw south of Alpine, Texas, had a yellow throat, and the rest was red going down the underparts. But let me tell you, that really threw me off. Everywhere else he was normal, but just had this yellow throat. It was really striking looking. Just another anomaly. I think if you look at birds long enough, you'll find anomalies on your own.
You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. You can give us a call tonight at 800-552-8502. And we do have three calls on hold right now. Clyde, you're on hold. And Tyler and or Hyler from Arkansas, you're on hold right now. We're going to go to Susan from Seville, Louisiana first. Susan, you're online with Cliff Shackelford. What's your question?
Hi, Cliff. I have a question about hummingbirds. April the 23rd, I left to go on vacation, and I have two hummingbird feeders, and I've been feeding hummingbirds for a long time, so I keep them clean and all that. I had seven hummingbirds. Well, I was leaving, and I left my husband in charge of, and he changed them, but in order, I was using some Perky Pet that I mixed with water, and they love that. But when I left, I wanted to make it easy for my husband, and I had the pre-mixed Pennington where all he had to do was shake it and pour it in there. Could the changing the food have caused them to leave? Because I don't, when I came home, I only had two hummingbirds, and now I haven't seen any.
So we've got to somehow get your husband off the hook here, right?
Yeah.
Sounds like car talk.
Yeah. You probably left him with too many honeydews. What else did he have to do while you were gone? I'm sure he had to feed himself. That's always difficult for husbands to do.
And he had to take care of a couple of animals.
Oh, and then
all that.
Yep, and he has to learn how to turn the TV off on his own to get to bed, right? That's difficult to do.
Yeah, because he loves to sit in front of the TV. Yep. I made him water all my plants and everything.
Oh, that's great. Well, I don't think that changing the food matters. I think what changes is that migration is over, and all these birds that are pouring through our area, they're going to points farther north. So they're passing through here, but they're headed to southern Canada, the Great Lakes states, etc. I think we see a drop off in numbers, and then all of a sudden you get to this point where feeders aren't enough. You have to have what I recommend is putting in a wildscape, which is nectar-giving plants in addition to the hummingbird feeder, but you've got also plants that are giving nectar and also plants that are attracting little insects, gnats and flies that these hummingbirds need to eat. So another thing happening in April are the females are going into nesting mode, and they're not real visible because guess what they're doing? Mm-hmm. They're tending to eggs. They're sitting on those eggs. They're feeding young when those eggs hatch, and they're very busy, and their life is very closely tied to that nest. So you just don't see females that much, and the males do their gallivanting all the time, and they're constantly showing off. And so I just think this is a typical question I get at Parks and Wildlife is what happened to the hummingbirds. Well, we don't have any indication that ruby-throated hummingbirds are on a decline. I think that, you know, we get our hopes up in migration. We see lots of birds in spring migration, especially in fall, but not really in the summer months in between. You just have to be lucky enough to have a bird breeding in your area and also be home in time to really see them, because otherwise they're very busy raising young, and they're not really hanging out the feeders as much. The mom is going to switch to a pure protein diet when she's feeding those young when they've hatched, because you don't get anything off that sucrose, that sugar water. You got to feed them protein in the form of insects, and that's for muscle growth. That's how those babies grow to be adults. Is with protein. So I think what I would recommend doing is the feeder. You're not even halfway there. You got to put in the wildscape to attract the bugs and the bees and the other things. And you'll also get butterflies and a whole bunch of other kinds of birds. I mean, we've got some records from our backyard that are only in the wildscape, like yellow-breasted chat and morning warbler. Mm-hmm. We're only in our wildscape. And so I can't tell you how wonderful putting all that in is, and it's not something you can do in a Saturday. You got to do it. It's kind of one of those things you do for life, and you keep making it grow and tending to it, and it's a lot less effort than putting in a lawn, I'll tell you that, because with San Augustine you're watering it a lot more than a wildscape. You're having to mow it every 6 or 8 days, which is more than you're going to do anything with your wildscape. So wildscape is also beneficial to your time budget and your wallet as well, because it doesn't need as much watering as a lawn.
Yeah, I have some lantana and coreopsis, and I have butterfly weed, and I do have, like you said, the little insects I can see. I have some tulip, the trumpet vine, I have that, and they also like the bleeding heart. I've seen them on my bleeding heart.
Okay.
So I do have a few.
Well, and you know, you've got the manpower in the hubby, right, that he could help and put in these diversity of plants, some more plants, and get that going. So maybe after the NBA finals, if he's a basketball fan, it's getting really going down the wire right now, and
just not during the baseball games.
Watch out for baseball. But
okay. Yeah.
All right, Susan.
All right. Well, I appreciate the information.
Thank you, Susan.
You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford, and you can give us a call tonight at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. Tyler, you're on hold for a few more minutes. Clyde, you're up next. Clyde, what's your question tonight for Cliff?
Well, actually, I was going to tell him I was just delighted to see a red-headed woodpecker in my neighborhood.
Oh, neat.
Here in the Acadoches.
Uh-huh.
Actually, it was perched on a phone pole.
Uh-huh. Cool. Yeah,
not drumming, but it was there. And I've heard a couple of woodpeckers drumming in the neighborhood, but I don't know if it was him or somebody else.
Uh-huh. Yep. So that's Red Billy that Bill's playing. He's cheating here. Well, that's not red-headed.
This is a red-headed
woodpecker. Yeah, and they are striking. Man, I love red-headed woodpecker. When they fly, that white is just pure bleached, starched white. It's just a gorgeous bird with that all red head. And I've seen them on telephone poles too, right where I bank. They're off of North Street. There's a pair that is behind my bank, and I see them on the telephone poles often. And that's where they'll drum. And the drumming is a form of communication where they're telling other red-headed woodpeckers, keep out, this is my home.
So. Right. I'm the big woodpecker in the neighborhood.
That would be the pileated. No.
Yeah.
That's what he's saying.
Yeah. Right. That's right. But that's a great bird to have, to have seen. I love red-headed woodpeckers.
Yeah. Me too. This yep. is on Virginia.
Cool.
But what I called about is a kind of a behavioral question.
Okay.
It seems like if I notice a roadkill, which, you know, happens every now and then, they either go in town and out. It seems like if it's a predator, I mean a cat or a dog or a coyote or something like that, that it doesn't seem to attract the scavenging critters near as much as rabbits or squirrels or deer
right.
do. Is that something I'm just thinking I'm seeing, or is it actually so?
No, that's so. There's several theories on that. I've read that it's the taste, the flavor. The carnivores don't taste as good. There's also possibly some fear those vultures might have in, you know, seeing that that's a dog or cat. In other words, a predator, don't get close to it. And I mean, the first one, you know, I agree that a rabbit sure tastes good, and but they sure like armadillos. I mean, it's amazing yeah. that they'll even eat skunks with the stench. But no, I think what you've noticed is pretty standard in the vulture world. Yep.
Okay. Well, it seems to affect crows as well. But
yeah,
I just wondered if it was something. You know, I have on occasion thought I saw something that wasn't really so.
Yeah, and you know, I don't know if, you know, when this roadkill's just super smeared, if it can't be identifiable, I don't know if that maybe gets vultures close, but maybe they avoid it after they taste it when they realize it's just not that carnivore flavor just isn't for them, I guess.
Apparently carnivores, I don't know how carnivores taste much. I didn't eat dog when I was
yeah.
over in the Orient. But I understand from various journals that the old mountain men said that the very best Rocky Mountain meat at all was cougar.
Huh. Well, and also
so,
when
you
you're
know,
yeah, and when you're
my taste to the vultures might not be the same.
Right, and those Rocky Mountain guys, when life is hard and you're hungry, boy, a shoe leather tastes good too.
Yeah.
So, but.
I thought I'd take advantage of you being on to ask if, you know, if that was a phenomenon that
I think
somebody
that's,
besides me observed.
Right. Well, Clyde, enjoy those red-headed woodpeckers that you're seeing.
I watch for them every morning now.
Okay, great. And thanks for the call, Clyde. Okay, bye.
You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford, and you can give us a call tonight at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. Any question regarding our avian world is fair game. And we have Kenny on hold right now from Shreveport. We're going to go next to Tyler from Arkansas. Tyler, what's your question tonight?
Well, thank you for having me on. I had a question about, I got some barn swallows out in the back.
Yep.
And at the same time, I got some martins, I got some blue jays all kind of mingling and that sort of thing around. And, you know, those barn swallows, you know, they're getting in there kind of causing a ruckus. They seem to be not getting along with the other birds. And I was just wondering, is there a humane way to get rid of them? Because I got my neighbors and they say, oh, just shoot them, and I don't, you know, believe in, you know, I just want to get rid of them because they're a little bit of a nuisance.
Yeah, well, keep in mind that those barn swallows are good neighbors to have. They're eating a lot of pesky flying insects that we would be spraying or being annoyed by. So I have to remind people that barn swallows are not that bad a neighbor to have because they're eating those things that we don't like. But the only way you can get rid of barn swallows is to remove the nest before the first egg is laid. So once an egg is laid, all bets are off. You have to leave it alone. The nest is protected under the Migratory Bird Treaty Act. But while they're building the nest, you've got several days that if you're paying attention, you don't like it, you can get out there and keep removing it. Maybe they'll get the hint and move on. But again, once that nest is completed and they've laid an egg, you can't touch it, and you got to let nature take its course. So if it seems like the swallows are fighting with the purple martins and the blue jays, you know, they've been co-occurring for millennia, a lot longer than we humans have settled here. So they've obviously gotten along. It might look like they're fighting over stuff, but they're probably doing just fine together. So if you can tolerate the barn swallows, I think it will be worth it in the end, just because of like what I mentioned about what they're eating that would benefit you. Okay?
Right. And see, my only issue with that was, you know, because I got a few little cats that kind of live out in the barn, and I feed them and that sort of thing.
Yeah.
And it seems that they kind of, well, I don't know if they're necessarily attacking the little cats and their kittens, or if they're just kind of, because, you know, sometimes I'll see them, they're out there, they'll swoop down a little bit and just kind of,
yeah,
they're
being good parents, but there's no weapon on a barn swallow that's going to hurt that cat. It's only going to hurt his feelings. It's not going to have scratches. It's not going to poke its eye out. They don't have sharp claws. They don't have a hooked beak. They're just being annoying to get that cat out of there because they're being a good parent. The bird is wanting to get that cat that's a would-be predator of their nest. They want to get that cat out of there. So don't worry about your cat getting his feelings hurt. I think he'll adjust to that. Yeah. All right, is that it, Tyler?
Oh, yeah, I think that's about it.
All right, man. Thanks for the call.
Thank you, Tyler. And you are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. You can give us a call tonight at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. Any question about birds in our avian world is fair game. And we go next to Kenny from Shreveport. Kenny, you're online with Cliff. What's your question?
Good evening, sir. How are you?
Hey, Kenny. What's up?
I was on a bicycle ride yesterday, and I found a scarlet tanager in the street of a residential area.
Uh-huh.
And he did not look injured. I thought maybe he was ill or stunned, and I picked him up and brought him home and didn't know what he was. I researched to find out what it was, and I found out they had dwindled in their population because of habitat loss and so forth.
Uh-huh.
And I had been giving him water. He's been drinking water, and I'm not expecting good news, but I was just wondering about, you know, if he has any chance or what I should do to help him, you know, maybe help him survive.
Yeah, so, you know, in the city he could have hit a window. Doesn't mean he'll fall right down at the base of the window. Sometimes birds get up and can move a great distance from. He could have just had a tussle with a cat. He could have flown low and across the road and got brazed by a vehicle. No telling what, but this really ties into what we talked about in the first couple minutes, is to have that wildlife rehabber number available. And so what you need to do when we're done talking, because time is of the essence, if you're feeding that bird just water, he's going to be dead in about 24 hours. And you're going to have to send it on to a licensed rehabilitator that knows what to do. Because we, you know, our heart is big and we think we're going to help something, but our brain doesn't know really what to do. So that's where your heart, you got to get your heart and brain on the same wavelength. And that ties back to what I said, is get the rehabber in your area and get that phone number and call them and get that bird over to them so they can do it.
I left an email with the Parks and Wildlife.
Yeah, they're not the right person. Parks and Wildlife is not it.
Just a Google rehab and then get to my...
Yeah. Go to the Louisiana Department of Game and Fish, and they have a website that lists all the rehabbers. So just put in your engine search, wildlife rehabilitators and Louisiana, and here comes a list. I just did it today. I checked to see if it... still there, and it'll you can look by where they're located and also what they tend to, because there are some rehabbers that says mammals only or raptors only. So you want to make sure you do get somebody that can do songbirds. And I would say do that right now, because that bird is not going to survive on water, no way.
Right, I understand that.
Okay.
Okay, I appreciate that information.
Great, thank you, Kenny.
Yes, sir.
Thank you, Kenny, and you are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. You can give us a call tonight at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. Any question concerning our avian world is welcome tonight, and we go next to Dennis from Leesville. Dennis, you're online with Cliff. What's your question?
Thank you very much.
Hey, Dennis.
My question is that my bird feeder, I've been seeing some little birds, not quite as big as sparrows. They're like blue-green in color.
Blue-green in color, and they're at your feeder right now?
Right, and I haven't been able to get close enough to get a picture.
Okay. There are female painted bunnings that are, I would say, a kind of a earthy leaf green color. I wouldn't say blue-green. So you might look up female painted bunning, and also first-year male painted bunnings look like mom as well. So
there is some birds that come in with them, but they're kind of brownish tan, that I figure might be the female.
Well, okay, there's indigo bunnings, but they're a sky blue. I wouldn't say they're blue-green. Would sky blue work for your bird?
No.
No?
When the sun hits them, they like iridescent, ever how you say that?
Iridescent.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, because there's also blue grosbeaks. They'll come into feeders and migration. So I think maybe it's tough to know what you're seeing, but I would say do an online search when the show's over and look up blue grosbeak, indigo bunting, and painted bunting. And with that latter one, look for the female, because you could also have mixed species. So you could have female painteds and female indigos, and that would explain why some of them are kind of greenish and why some are brown, because the female indigo is brown, kind of a tan color.
And Dennis, if you can get a photo, you can send it in to us.
Oh, yeah.
And we'll be glad to identify it from the photo.
Yeah, we can
talk. I tried that, but when you try to sneak up on them, they take off.
It is tough. So I think this is the way we're going to have to do it. You're going to have to make the decision based on those three choices and see. But again, it could be a mix of those. And it sounds more like you got females of both painted and indigo bunnings coming to the feeder. And that's pretty common in migration. But that'll shut down unless you're in a very rural setting. If you're in an urban setting, those birds will leave urban settings to go out in the country, but people that live in the country could get those all summer long. So I would say look up the painted bunting female and the indigo bunting female, and that's maybe what you have. It's hard for me to do this without seeing through your eyes.
Yeah.
Okay, I'm writing that down.
Okay.
The whippoorwills are singing.
Yep, those are Chuck Will's widows. Yep.
Oh, yeah. I remember the whippoorwill when I was small.
Yeah, we call them all whippoorwills, but all the whippoorwills have passed through our area. Unless you live in the Wachitas, that's about as far south as they breed. But all the ones that are here right now that are going to call all summer long are Chuck Will's widows. And it's a close relative of the whippoorwill. Okay?
Thank you for the show. I certainly appreciate it.
All right, Dennis. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford, and you can give us a call tonight at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. Any question concerning our avian world is fair game. We lost Deanne, so if you're listening, Deanne, you can call in now. Our lines are open. We're going to go next to George from Bossier City. George, you're online with Cliff. What's your question?
Well, I don't really have a question. I just wanted to send some pictures. I called last year and was asking about a bird that I thought was a Mississippi kite.
Uh-huh.
And you said it most likely was.
Okay.
Well, I finally got a good picture. I've been trying for years to get a picture. I was out here at the Barksdale Air Show. Well, I was in front of my house at the Barksdale Air Show, and I got some terrific pictures of airplanes. But also, in the lull between the show, there's some Mississippi kites overhead, and I had my 300 millimeter lens on.
Uh-huh.
I got some pretty good pictures. I'd like to send them to you.
Yeah.
I also got some fantastic pictures of ruby-throated hummingbirds.
Oh, good.
I didn't know such a thing existed. I was working for my photo class trying to get pictures.
Mm-hmm.
And I went out here to the Red River Bird Sanctuary.
Yeah.
And they got a feeder right off the end of the porch there. They got a bunch of bird nuts out there, if it's not too derogatory of a term. But anyhow, they sit out there and take pictures of the birds at feeders, and them hummingbirds are just beautiful. I'd never seen anything like that. They turn towards the light.
Yeah.
And their throat, it's amazing.
It is.
But I got some pretty good pictures I'd like to send to you.
Yeah.
So you were talking about the injured bird. Out here where I work at Martin Transport, they had a red-tailed hawk come out to the wash rack where I was at, and he was clearly injured.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the guys there at work called, I don't know who they called, but these two ladies come out, and they really knew what they were doing. They captured that hawk and took him and
rehabilitated it. Yeah, and I think that's the key. These are people that know what they're doing. Just simple thing like, you know, knowing to wear some gloves and get an old towel to cover the bird, because a red-tailed hawk's got some powerful feet. And if you go up to it with your big heart and you haven't used your head, he's going to rip you up, tear you up with those claws. So, yep, the rehabbers know what they're doing, and we should let them do their job. So one comment about the pictures, your kites and your hummingbird pictures, it sounds like you've got a new hobby, George, and I think you're a budding nature photographer. So congratulations on that, because chances are you're going to live longer, you're going to be stress-free because you're going to be outside more, and you're going to have something to do in your off time. So congratulations to you, George.
Well, thank you. I was doing this for photo class, but birds are a great thing to
do. Oh, yeah. No, you were doing it for class, but you got the bug, and I think you don't realize it, but this is like crack cocaine. It's addictive. But it's healthy. It's good for you.
Tune in for the next episode of The Better Picture on Red River Radio, and we'll have some guys to give you some tips on shooting better pictures.
Yeah, that's right. Okay. Well, thank you, George. Thanks for the call.
Oh, and George, if you'd like to send those photos in, you can send them to my email address. That's okay. wbeckett@lsus.edu, and we'll be happy to use those on the next show.
Yep. Thanks, George.
All right, I'll do it. Thanks very much.
Okay.
All right, thank
Bye-bye.
You. You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford, and we can take your calls tonight at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. We go next to Marianne from Minden. Marianne, what's your question tonight?
You're not on with Marianne. You're on with Wallace from Alexandria.
Oh, well, they switched up on me. Then I don't know what happened to Marianne. So, Wallace, what's your question tonight?
Well, I've got chimney swifts, and a lot of them, I think. And my concern is I hear them during the day, you know, moving around fine, and I have babies. And sometimes I'm concerned when they fall. Like, the babies, I hear them, like, in the fireplace at the bottom.
Yeah.
Is there something I should do, or should I just ignore it, mess with it, don't mess with it? I want to do the right birds, provide them a home, but
right.
I don't want
to. No, you're doing a really cool service, because these are insectivores. We mentioned how barn swallows are eating a lot of bugs. Well, the chimney swifts are too. Well, the good thing is this is a time of the year when we don't need to be making fires. It's already hot enough. So just close your damper and be done with it. So if they do fall, they fall on that, and they won't come down into the house and be a problem. So they'll fall
on...
So
my house is way old.
Okay.
You can, so we don't have a damper?
You can make one. And you just need to get some basic measurements, cut a piece of wood, figure out how to prop it without any gaps. And that way, if they do fall, which is not uncommon, they'll fall on that device that you're going to rig.
Yeah.
And they can still be fed. They can still practice flight. And guess what? Baby swifts eventually are strong enough to fly themselves straight up out of the chimney.
Okay.
So what you don't want is it to fall in to where your logs, your fake logs, your real logs are sitting, because then then the mom will come in and she'll see you, and she won't go straight up. She'll come right out and fly to the window, and you got a big debacle.
Mm-hmm.
So my question, okay, so the house is really old, but we do have a cover over the fireplace. So there's actually no exposure. There's no opening. They're not going to see an opening.
Okay.
And I've heard them in there in the base, and I haven't messed with it.
Yeah.
So don't mess with it, is what you're telling me.
No, I'm saying close whatever device you have.
I do.
Because if you're hearing them, and it might sound like an army of swifts, but typically there's only going to be one nest per chimney.
I really hope you're right.
Yeah.
I've gone outside. I mean, you really think just one nest? Because I've gone outside and watched them come in and escape, and there's a... It feels like a fairly significant number. It's the same amount of birds.
You'll see them flying around in groups, maybe six or eight at a time, but typically they all retreat to their own chimney for nesting.
So even if I'm hearing like three or four voices at once in the birds, you know, in the chimney, that's normal. Like,
because it could already be young that have hatched, and you're hearing babies saying, "Feed me, feed me, feed me, feed me." So they're hungry, and so they're going to be making a lot of chattering noise.
Yeah.
But they're fantastic birds to have. So unfortunately, we cap our chimneys a lot in the newer homes, and they don't have a spot for them to nest. Right. And guess what? Chimneys weren't around 300 years ago. So what did they use? They used hollow trees that were shaped like a chimney. So basically, a giant hollow tree that was topped by maybe wind event that topped it, and that's exactly what chimney swifts historically nested in naturally. And then we came along and built these things that they said, "Hey, look at all these hollow trees, but they're really chimneys." So that's So that's where the chimney swift is.
Well, can I help them? Can I do anything for them?
Nope.
Just be a landlord.
You've already done your part by not capping your chimney. I mean, that you get a gold star for that right there. Yeah.
I'm a budding ornithologist.
There you go.
There you go.
New.
There you go.
They got me started watching birds. Actually.
Cool. Well, that's great.
It's good.
And hopefully you have fewer pesky insects because of the chimney swifts.
And I do have a question for you, Cliff, as far as safety for her. Should she then make sure that she has a chimney sweep come to clear that stuff and that debris out before she uses that fireplace in the wintertime?
That's not a bad idea. And just make sure that's done in the fall or the winter, you know, before you start a fire. But the nest is usually pretty small. And what's interesting about a chimney swift nest is it's made of really small little twigs, like almost the size of toothpicks. And do you know what they're connected with?
Spit, I'd imagine.
Yes, very good. With saliva. And so it's like a glue. And so they connect it, not only all the sticks together, but the whole thing to the wall of the chimney. And so actually a cleaner chimney with less soot is better for the adhesiveness. So it isn't a bad idea to have a sweep come in. And actually, you know, they'll tell you, I don't know if it's true, but that getting rid of that soot is healthier on your fireplace too. So
absolutely, we get it cleaned anyway once a year.
Oh, good.
Okay.
Well, then you're in good shape. Yeah, you get a gold star already. So you asked what you can do for the chimney sweeps. You've already done it. Slam dunk. Great work.
Last question for you: is there anything I can do to bring more hummingbirds to my yard? Is there besides the feeder? They don't seem to go.
And a couple calls ago, I mentioned about a wildscape. And if you just turned on the radio, I'm happy to sing the praise of putting in a wildscape. A wildscape is landscaping for wildlife. It's putting out plants that are not only native, but they give back to nature. So nectar giving for hummingbirds and butterflies, berry giving for our cedar waxwings and robins and so forth. So I would say investigate a wildscape and doing some gardening for wildlife, and that's how you can attract your hummingbirds and butterflies and other species as well.
Okay.
Yep, it's very rewarding.
All right, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Wallace. You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. You can give us a call tonight at 800-552-8502. Lines are open. That's 800-552-8502. And we go next to Jeannie from Shreveport. Jeannie, what's your question tonight for Cliff?
Well,
I'd like to know if the Bickham Dixon Park is still open, because not too long, well, it's been several years since I saw them down there, but the Canadian geese were migrating and there were flocks of them there, and I'd like to, you know, go down there and take pictures again. And there were some swans down there too, and it was a great birding area, but I'm just wondering, is that park closed to the public now?
I don't know that park.
Is that the park in Shreveport just off of Burt Coons where it merges with 70th?
Right.
That had gotten flooded when we had all of the flooding, and I drive by there on a regular basis. The gates are still closed, but I do believe you can walk down in there. They just don't want you driving down in there. But
okay.
I would check with the local parks department and see if that is open for people to walk down there. I know I see cars parked around that regularly. They're off the side of the road, so it's like people are just taking their fishing poles, because that's a favorite fishing pond for a lot of people, including myself, and they just take their fishing pole down there. But I imagine it's walkable, but I don't think it's drivable, because they haven't cleared out all of the mud and sludge and everything else. The water was all the way up to the road at one point.
Wow.
Oh, okay. Because, I mean, that was a great area, and I remember fondly, you know, going down there and just having a great time photographing these birds. I mean, they're fabulous. So, as far as birding areas in Shreveport, what are the best ones that you know of?
Well, there's the Red River National Wildlife Refuge just to the southeast of town. That's a really good spot to go.
Is that over in Bossier or is that in Shreveport?
I believe that's south in Shreveport, but I don't know.
Okay.
You can look it up, though. Red River, what is it? Red River Wildlife Preserve?
Yeah, yep.
Oh, okay.
And I'm not a local boy. I live 98 miles from here, so I'm sorry.
They can tell you where to go in Texas. So.
Yeah. Okay. So I don't have all the local stuff down, but...
that's good to know.
Yep. So try looking up that Red River National Wildlife Refuge. I don't think it's named. It's got a similar name to this radio station. How about that?
There you go. Okay. Yeah, there's a river near here for that reason. Also, a Lake Bistineau State Park, which is just about 25, 30 minutes over on the other side of Doyling. It's a beautiful state park, and of course, it's a state park, so it's all a wild area, and there's plenty to do out there for birding, and they actually have a park ranger there that could help you go out, and maybe you could schedule a tour or something like that if you wanted an educational experience.
That's a good point. I'm glad Bill mentioned that. You know, start with your state parks, your local parks, start with your refuges. These are public places that often have boardwalks and maybe kiosks and have habitat to track birds. So start there and then go from there, and you'll meet other people, and they'll tell you about these maybe hidden or unknown places to go birding, and it just keeps growing, and all of a sudden you're going to have your top 10 favorite sites to go birding.
And my man behind the curtain here said the Wildlife Refuge is in Bossier, that's our person in there answering the phone calls. So.
Okay. Well, thank you so much. I appreciate your help.
All right, thank you.
You're welcome. Mm-hmm. You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. All lines are open right now if you'd like to get your call in at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. We're going to go next to a critter that is not a bird. However, you might mistake this for a bird shrieking at some time.
Yeah, let's listen to this sound alike. Here it comes again. Listen. And I get a lot of calls about this. Here's one more. Get a lot of calls about what's this bird that's whining in the backyard. That's not a bird. This is the eastern gray squirrel. And the gray squirrel is also known as a cat squirrel by colloquial name and hunter name. They'll call him a cat squirrel. Sounds like he's kind of meowing. But to some ears, it sounds like a bird vocalizing. Mm-hmm. So you can look really hard for something to fly away as you approach it. And we've done this a lot with frog calls that are very bird-like. But here we're introducing a mammal that sounds similar to a bird. And so, again, this is the gray squirrel.
And true story, I have one of these in my yard where I live, and our neighbor's cat and it are constantly at odds with each other. So I hear that all day long,
yep.
Screeching outside my window. So
fussing at the cat.
At the cat. I even saw a bird out there once just scolding that cat, and the cat was just like, I'm not having anything to do with you. I'm not hungry right now. But the bird was just going off on it.
So. Yeah, neat.
You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford, and the number to call is 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. Ted from Longwood, you're next. What's your call tonight? Hello, Ted?
Bird.
Okay, there you go. Are you there?
Can you hear me now?
Yeah, go ahead. No, it wasn't you. It was me.
Walter B. Jacobs Park. It's located in Caddo Parish. It's a Caddo Parish facility. It's on the Blanchard Fir Road. It's 7 miles west of Blanchard. They have bird rehab programs and all kinds of nature walks.
Cool. All right.
That Red River wildlife that you were talking about,
uh-huh.
That's on the Arthur Ray Teague Parkway,
right
north of the Jimmy Davis Bridge, about a mile north of that on the east side of the Red River. And a second place to look for birds would be Caddo Lake State Park on the Texas side,
yep.
In Karnak, Texas.
Yep.
And it's 34,000 acres of wetlands. And another place would be the Bodkaw and Dorchy wildlife areas over in Webster Parish, Bossier Parish.
Cool.
And Minden.
Excellent.
Those are both 34,000 acre impoundments that have boat launches and facilities. And there's also in Uncertain, in Karnak, a national bird wildlife refuge, the old Morton Thiokol plant.
Mm-hmm. Yep. That's called Caddo National Wildlife Refuge.
All right.
Yep, and that's the old Longhorn Army ammunition plant.
That's correct.
Yep,
and
yep.
John Henley and them did a lot of recycling and reclaiming.
Right. Yep, and those are great spots. Ted, I appreciate you listing all those. This is great information, and thanks for helping us out. We need all the help we can get with some of these calls, so thanks so much.
Here's one question that I need for my grandsons, because I've been buying them different books and I live on a farm out in Longwood, but what would we recommend for earliest and all people that are interested, like Roger B. Torrey has a book on birds and things and how to identify them. What would you say would be something to start with?
There for you're talking about for your youngsters. There's
all
of it. Yeah, well,
in all of it.
I think well for the youngsters, there's a really clever book by Bill Thompson. And I don't remember the title of it, but just look up Bill Thompson. He's the editor of Birdwatcher's Digest, and he wrote a book for youngsters. It's really cool because he talks about the boring stuff that we all need to go through, like the range map and what the bird looks like and sounds like. But he also has a little part that he injects into each species account of, here's a cool fact. And it's stuff that would make kids' eyes get really big, like, wow, really? And I'm not gonna be able to remember any of them, and nor do I want to give you the punchline instead. And I've got no affiliation with this book whatsoever, but I would recommend it. You're asking me what book to recommend for young birders. I think that one is really good by Bill Thompson. So check that one out and order it. And it's really good for beginning birders too, not just for kids. But for beginning birders as well. I think it's a really good read.
Well, thank you so much.
Okay.
I was driving home from work, and I was listening to this, and I called them, and I said, y'all need to turn it on, and appreciate all y'all are doing.
All right, Ted, thank you for your help.
Thank you, Ted. And I love our listener base. Give us a call at 800-552-8502, and you can get your calls and so much information out there.
We don't
even
need Google to look up answers. The next caller does
there
it.
You go.
I mean, that's just awesome and
cool.
Very quick.
We call that people. There you go.
That's right.
We're going to go next quickly to Ann from Shreveport. What's your question tonight, Ann?
This is probably a very naive question. You professional birdwatchers are going to laugh at this question, but, you know, we have had an invasion of white-winged doves into our backyard.
Uh-huh.
And I find the call of the white-winged dove and a barred owl to be somewhat similar.
Oh, that,
you notice that?
Yeah, that's not silly at all, because we get a lot of phone calls at Parks and Wildlife asking what those owls are that are calling all day long. But you're right, it's very owl-like. And so I don't think that's silly at all. I think that's great. And so it is confusing when they're hooting, or, you know, they're cooing.
Not the mourning dove, is
no,
it?
No, this is the white-winged dove that, like Ann said, has been a recent colonizer. And they've spread throughout a lot of the U.S. or even reaching into southern Canada. And they like urban areas. And right behind it has been the Eurasian collar dove. Doves just really do well in urban settings. I mean, they do well. We have feeders. We've got bird baths. We've got lots of shade trees, and they just feel comfortable in that setting. They like to feed in mowed lawns. They eat grit on our parking lot. So all these different doves, because we also have mourning doves and Inca doves. And it's just a really good place for these doves and pigeons to be in our cities. So, but
yeah. I wondered if other Shreveport birders have noticed what we have noticed. 2 years ago, we saw a lot of Eurasian collar doves.
Mm-hmm.
Last year and this year, we've seen almost none. And I have not seen an Inca dove in probably 4 years.
Yeah, and Inca doves, they seem to be very vulnerable to cats in cities. So they just sit there way too long, and Mr. Cat can catch them. So you see this as a problem in cities with Inca doves. Now, I don't know if there's a decline in Eurasian collar doves where I'm at. I mean, they seem like they're rooted deeply now, and especially in industrial sides of town. Maybe if you've got agriculture, you'll see them. I was in remote Gonzales County, Texas yesterday, between Gonzales and Luling, and we were out in the middle of nowhere, and there's one house and a bunch of pasture land, and there's collar doves. And so that just goes to show you that they can be in even remote settings, as long as there's that house with the feeder and the bird bath going that I presume this one had. There's agriculture in the area too, and that really helps collar doves too when there's grain spillage, for example. Okay. So they really like all that. So yeah, you can see collar doves just about anywhere.
Well, thank you for your answer to my question. I'm glad to see that I was absolutely right.
Yep, you were, Ann. Very good ears on those. Thank you.
Thank you, Ann. And we've got time quickly for one more. Alan from Livingston, we need a quick question from you, so we've got to move on. What's your question tonight?
Okay, just a real quick one then. Are the ivory bills truly extinct?
Extinct?
Extinct, yeah.
In my opinion, you betcha, because I haven't seen any proof. You're from Livingston, and in Texas, the last documented record is 1904. So I don't like anything that's come since then. There's been, you know, speculation, some rumors, and then just a lot of mess, but not a slam dunk photo in a long time. So my short answer to this quick question is, yes, I think they're extinct, and I don't like saying that at all.
Okay, great, thanks.
Great, thanks, Alan.
Thank you, Alan. And that is going to wrap it up. We're going to move on to our conservation moment this month, our conservation tip. What do you have for us, Cliff?
Well, we tie our profiled species to our conservation tip, and this one is going to tie into the eastern meadowlark, and the conservation tip is on native grasses. So when asked what habitats in our world have been heavily altered or degraded, most biologists and ecologists in North America would emphatically reply, well, that'd be our wetlands. And they'd be correct. But nothing's been altered or degraded more than our native grasslands, once rich with a diversity of grasses and forbs. These grasses have been converted extensively to urban settings, parking lots, and coastal Bermuda fields. To appreciate the decline in our native grasslands, simply look at the continental declines in our grassland obligate birds, species that can occur nowhere else, including several species of prairie grouse and quail, several species of raptors, about a dozen species of sparrows and longspurs, and lots more. In the Red River listing area, historical grasslands would have included two major habitat types, both with a lush ground cover of native grasses and forbs. These are prairies and open pine savannas, and both were maintained with frequent naturally occurring fire. The next time you're thinking of planting grasses on your property, consider reintroducing a mix that includes what are known as the four horsemen of the prairie: the little blue stem, the big blue stem, the Indian grass, and the switchgrass. These four species were the dominants of our area's grasslands and, if maintained, can provide homes for many grassland animals, both vertebrate and invertebrate alike. So bring back a little history into your life and onto your property. Do it for the birds.
All right. Thanks, Cliff. And you have been listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford, who is the statewide non-game ornithologist for the Texas Parks and Wildlife Department. We want to thank everybody from the Texas Parks and Wildlife Department for their help on this program. And I personally want to thank Cliff for joining me tonight and lending his expertise.
Well, it's been fun. And thank you, Bill, for manning all the equipment here.
There we go. This program is produced by Bill Beckett and Cliff Shackelford with help from Wally Derleth, Henry Edwards, and Tim Schnell tonight. The audio for tonight's program will be posted to our website in the next few hours, and then you can listen to the program again. And all of the photos that we discussed that were sent in tonight, as well as the sounds of the gray squirrel, were all on our website as well at redriverradio.org. You are listening to Red River Radio, and we are your community-supported public broadcasting service from LSUS. This is KDAQ Shreveport-Bossier City, KLSA Alexandria Pineville, KBSA El Dorado Magnolia, and KLDN Lufkin Nacogdoches. We also broadcast online on the World Wide Web at redriverradio.org. Stay tuned. We have Radio Lab coming up next, and our next program of What's Bugging You will be on the third Tuesday next month. We hope you'll tune in with Dr. Beverly Burden as we discuss our insect world here on Red River Radio.